Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Diary of an F1 Boss is brought to you by Rye House Kart Raceway, the home of the next Mist Apex karting event on April 20th. Join us by going to mistapexpodcast.com/karting. You are listening to Mist Apex Podcast. We live F1. You're listening to Mist Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spannersready, and I'm joined by token American Nick Numbers Alexander. Hi, Nick. Thanks for subbing in for Matt.
We have substituted the regularly scheduled American co-host. Let's see if anyone notices.
Probably not. We are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. We're also joined by ex-Lotus CEO and Mist Apex favourite friend of the show, Matthew Carter. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, how are you?
Now, remember when back in 2013, 2014, everyone was talking about shady operatives coming in and taking over Lotus? That was Matthew Carter.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't me at all.
You know,
it was a gentleman by the name of Mansoor Ijaz.
All right. Okay.
That's foxed you, hasn't it? Look.
Yeah, I reckon that's just a pseudonym. You can't fool us for long.
Go Google it. What's the best way to describe him? A charlatan, shall we say?
Oh, really?
He managed to come to a number of races on the promise that he was just about to send hundreds of millions of pounds to buy the team. And he dragged it on for So if you do Google him from memory, there's a picture of him at the 2013 Monaco Grand Prix. So that must have been May 2013. I took over in December and he still had the team on the hook on the premise that he was just about to pay.
And is that the sort of root of the money problems, is it then, that Lotus had?
I think it potentially didn't help. I know we've talked about this before, but 2013, Lotus was very competitive. That was when Kimi was winning a few races and Roman was doing pretty well as well. And the owners sort of fell into that trap, and the designers were constantly telling them that if they just threw another 5 million here or 5 million there, that they would get some more track speed. And at that time, this gentleman popped up with his promise of hundreds of millions. So I certainly, I don't think it helped. It maybe contributed to the money issues.
So for new listeners to Mist Apex Podcast, so you are not naturally a motorsport team principal. You didn't grow up in London dreaming of being the next Toto Wolff. You came through it through money and ended up in team wear on a pit wall.
I think I was a natural at it.
Well, you would say that.
I came through... you say through money, not my money by any stretch of the imagination. It was through the guys that owned the team at Lotus. Yeah, I was employed by the people that owned the team on other projects. And then this became, Lotus became one of their more money-sapping projects. So they put me in there to try and sort things out.
So you got parachuted in, not like a works team where they go, okay, we're going into F1. Here's your budget. Here's your big Renault budget of £150 million a year. Go. It was more a case of protecting the investment, I suppose.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if we ever really got into the numbers before, but 2013, which was the year. So I came in at the very end of the 2013 season. So as we were just saying, that was a year that they were, Lotus was fairly competitive. Well, it was actually second in the championship for quite a period of time. And in that year, in that calendar year, they managed to lose £64 million loss. I mean, these are all public figures, so I'm not saying anything that's not out there in the real world. They lost £64 million on £120 million turnover.
Wow.
So Nick as a numbers man will appreciate the interesting nature that holds. So I came in on the back of that terrible loss. First year that I was in charge, which was 2014, I cut the loss from £64 million to £5 million by laying off people and just cutting expenses and just generally being a little bit more businesslike rather than sportslike.
So I wasn't planning on talking accounting on the Formula One podcast today. So we'll keep it general business. So for our American listeners, when he says turnover, he just means revenue.
You've gone on mute somehow.
Okay. I have this theory and you can confirm or deny or extrapolate to your heart's content. But I mean, would you say that being the CEO of a Formula One team is not entirely different than being the CEO of anything else?
I would wholeheartedly agree. In fact, in many ways, as a business model, it's much simpler than most other businesses. So I run other businesses for the two owners, many other businesses for them. And Formula One, really, there's only two forms of income. So you've got the money that you get from your sponsors and the money you get from, it was Bernie at the time, now it's Liberty. And they're pretty much set at the start of the season. So you know exactly what's coming in. It's just a case of managing your expenditure. I honestly, I think it's very, very similar to many other businesses. And that was kind of the way I approached it when I went in there. I mean, you've got a HR department, you've got a marketing department, you've got an accounting department, and I just ran it as I would any other business, apart from the fact that the end product was two cars going around a racetrack. The variable or the curveball is the fact that you've got the business being judged and assessed every 2 weeks against its main competitors in a very, very public forum. And there's nowhere to hide. And also, obviously, the other aspect that I wasn't necessarily used to was the publicity and the journalists and the TV cameras.
And the media. So you've got to sit there and do a press conference suddenly on a sporting stage. And some of those messages are so sort of banal. And I guess early on, a lot of them were very sporty specific. So did you ever feel like, uh-oh, I'm going to get found out any second here?
Yeah, I think we've had this discussion before. I was slightly embarrassed after my first race when I was asked a few questions and I didn't really necessarily know the answer to historic things. So I ginned up on it very, very quickly. I suddenly sort of immersed myself in Formula One in any way that I could.
Well, the CEO really shouldn't necessarily know all the weeds and details, especially historically speaking, of everything that ever happened in the business. It's your understanding to get a snapshot and understand where the business is at a point in time and then kind of what you can do from there. So it's really interesting. You've kind of confirmed my understanding that the money that you have coming in is relatively set, but isn't it true that as you try to spend more money to earn more money, it's not necessarily a linear input output kind of relationship? I mean, wouldn't you get big jumps in revenue for finishing at different steps on the constructor's ladder, if you will? How does that affect your decision making?
Completely. Well, for a team like Lotus at the time, very much so, because in rough, broad numbers, it's about $10 million difference per position that you finish in the Constructors' Championship. So I know I've had this discussion stroke argument on here before, but that's why to the teams, the Constructors' Championship is more important than the Drivers' Championship. And that can make a huge difference. So go back to 2013, as I was talking about before, Lotus fell from second to fourth, because Kimi stopped driving for them. So Kimi signed his contract to go to Ferrari, developed a mysterious back problem that meant he couldn't drive the last three races, and the team dropped from second to fourth. So there was At the time, it was a little bit more than $10 million. So I think it was about $25 million difference.
So I have to have the opportunity here, a unique opportunity to maybe stick it to Spanners a little bit. So I think Spanners will often speculate or assert that Ferrari do not care about the Constructors' Championship, that they only care about the Drivers' Championship.
Not exactly what I said, but
that's exactly what you said, and we're going to dispel it publicly.
What I've said is, if it came down to a situation, they would take, I think, the prestige, because there's a big media value to having the champ. And if it was for the title, not necessarily in the midfield, but if you've got the champ the next season, that's a big deal. And I reckon that has a value all of its own.
Well, it doesn't have a monetary value unless you, I guess you could say that would generate more potential sponsor, but I don't think, and Ferrari is a anomaly slightly, because I genuinely don't think they necessarily worry too much about the money side of things. They've got their crazy deal that they signed with Bernie that gives them more than anyone else anyway. They've got all their historical payments and rights and revenues that Bernie really bent over backwards to make sure they would stay in the sport. Yeah, I get for now, but it would be really tricky to play hardball with them.
Matthew, before we get too much into the weeds of future revenue splitting and cost caps and regulations for 2021, it's interesting. I don't think I quite picked up the fact that you basically did a moniker in Friends and you had to go into a new position and just immediately lay off people who were friends with each other, who were in families. Did that make you like immediately unpopular? Were you like Matthew Hatchett Carter?
I've done it many, many times in many businesses, and I would like to think no. I'm not sure how much of the minutiae you want to get into, but on day one, I addressed all 600 members of staff at Lotus. So bear in mind, these towards the end of 2013, and again, this is all public, so I'm not saying anything untoward. Towards the end of 2013, there was a number of months when the staff didn't get paid. They did get paid eventually, but they got paid very late. So everyone was in that frame of mind where they appreciated that the business was clearly not going well. So day one, I addressed all 600 staff, and I remember to this day, they put me on a pallet on a forklift truck and lifted me up in the air so that I could talk to them, so that I could be slightly raised up from them in the main
like an emperor. Everyone had to have their head below Matthew Carter's eye level.
It was more so they could see me, to be fair. And I said to them at the time, I said, you know, I'm here to try and rescue things, to try and help things out. And there's going to have to be some changes. We're going to have to do some restructuring. So if any of you have got opportunities elsewhere, or if any of you are approaching retirement age and you want to take early retirement, or if any of you, you know, have got any reason that you may want to be one of the first out the door, then, you know, by all means, come and see me and we can try and arrange that. I've always found that by being perfectly upfront and honest like that, that people tend to realize that what you're doing is for the greater good. It's not, I wasn't there to really, really upset anyone. And I think we've had this discussion before. So that was day one. I started the process very quickly. And then by about day 9 or 10, so bear in mind, when I came in, I said to the owners, I know nothing about Formula One. I can run the business side of you. And they said, don't worry, we've got Eric Boulier. He's going to run all the racing side for you. You just need to run the business side. So I said, okay, no problem. So day 9 or 10, Eric comes into my office and says that he's been offered the job at McLaren. And it's like a footballer being offered a position at Man United. It was his dream job, and he couldn't possibly say no. So I said, okay, fine. Rang the owners immediately and said, look, you know, we've got a slight problem here. And they said, no problem. We're going to fax you through a list of potential replacements. I think it was still a fax then. Maybe not. Anyway, they sent me through a list of potential replacements, and I think the lowest value of a salary was somewhere in the region of £500,000. And I had literally come out of a meeting with someone who was earning about 25,000, who I was potentially going to have to lay off. So I then went back to the owners and said, impossible, I can't do this. You know, it goes against every grain of my feelings about, you know, this job and this position. And they said, okay, well, you need to deal with it and sort it out. So I called in the senior staff, a guy called Alan Permain, who's the sporting director. the guy who famously had the argument with Kimmy when Kimmy told him to shut up, I know what I'm doing. And he said, look, I can take over most of what Eric does at the track, apart from the media and the meetings that all the team principals need to go to. So if you can do that and you can do the business side, I think we can get through without having to replace him.
That's interesting. So how come he didn't fancy that? Is he just not that kind of guy? How come he didn't fancy doing just the media side of it? Or did he feel like...
Yeah, I think he genuinely is not that kind of guy. And I think he was also doing his own job, which is... So as I say, his title is sporting director, I think. So he is kind of, he's on the pit wall. He's the go-to guy on the pit wall. So back in the day, you would very rarely have heard, in fact, I don't think you ever heard Eric Lillier over the pit radio, but Alain Permain, you certainly would have done. So he was that guy. So he had his own job and we sort of carved up Eric's responsibilities, which weren't that many, to be fair. And then we went racing with effectively me as team principal and CEO. And that was why in my first press conference, I appreciate CEOs don't need to know history about sport and teams, but I did look like a bit of a muppet in the first the first media briefing because I was like a fish out of water.
So they do this in companies quite a lot. I'm sure everybody will have had an experience where a middle manager has left and they simply gap those responsibilities by just giving people below and above more work to do. You don't think of that from an F1 team principal. Our Boulier's gone. Oh, well, it's all right. We'll just gap it. We'll get Fred to do the press conferences. We'll get Matthew to do the team meetings. You go, wow, that's a heck of a way to run an organization. Sorry, Nick, you were trying to get in, mate.
Yes. So just more questions about that first day. So I can't believe, first of all, that they lifted you up on a forklift because that seems horribly unsafe. Nowadays, the forklift would have a halo around the pallet, I think, to hold you in. A European in the chat room wants to know if they, you know, he seems a little bit surprised that they actually lowered you back down after a speech like that. Was that in your mind? Did you think that
vulnerable.
You don't like, deliver such bad news for risk of being left high and dry?
I, without wishing to blow my own trumpet at all, I think it was good news. I think that they hadn't really been, as a collective, they'd not really been spoken to for a number of months. They'd gone through times when they hadn't been paid, when they saw Kimmy walk away. They saw Kimmy very publicly tell everyone that he hadn't been paid for over a year.
I wanted to ask you about that. So okay. Darren Johnston in the chat room, one of our moderators and patrons wanted to ask if there was any validity to that statement. I mean, you said that the staff had not been being paid. Is the driver not just the most expensive staff?
Yeah. So Kimmy hadn't been paid for over a year. So Kimmy, again, I think we've had this discussion, and again, I think it's fairly public. When Kimmy came back into the sport when Lotus signed him, he's quite clever. His manager's a guy called Steve Robertson, and they were quite clever. They did a deal whereby he got a basic salary, and then he got a bonus of 50,000 euros per point that he scored.
Sure, so
his first race back was Australia 2012, which he won. So he got 25 points. So he got €500,000 bonus. Then the second race, I think he came second, so he got 18 points. This was within 1 month. So within that month, he'd already racked up nearly not far short of €1 million worth of bonuses. And he continued through the season like that. And by the time I came in at the end of 2013, he had a winding up petition against the company for €15 million of wages that he hadn't been paid.
So we've talked about entering the sport in the way you have and teams being funded by investors. So I don't think that's a model we currently have, is it, with any teams at the moment?
Well, I guess you could say Racing Point, maybe.
Ah, right. Okay. Yeah, I tend to think of that as a shadow front for the reality that is Lawrence Stroll setting up a Lance vehicle.
Oh, but that's the question you asked, wasn't it? What was the question you asked?
Yeah, no.
Funding? Yeah, investors. Racing Point. I mean, I guess you could say Haas to a certain extent. My thoughts on Haas are that it's a way for Gene Haas to promote his business. It's tricky. Yeah, there's not many. I think most of them are anything that's not a major car company is generally there for another reason. I mean, a Red Bull there to race or a Red Bull there to sell fizzy drinks?
We've got a question actually from, I think this one was from Twitter. It's Vara Salander. And he says, have you watched the Netflix series? And if so, How does the relationship you had with Romain Grosjean compare with the one Günther Steiner has in the series? Were you as blunt? Were you as direct with Roman?
No. I would say that you have to bear in mind that I had two drivers, and you generally tend to need to score points. And one of my drivers wasn't particularly good at scoring points, and the other one was Romain. So I was fairly blunt with him, but I couldn't be quite as blunt. But I went through the same frustrations. I mean, Romain crashed under a safety car in the wet once. Romain had a number of shunts and bumps. But the thing with Romain is he's very, very, when he's, and I think Günther said this, when his head is in the right place, he is very, very fast. And very, very consistent. So my relationship with Romain was, I'm probably not as blunt as Günther, but a little bit more sort of arm around the shoulder, I guess.
So are you relieved that there was no Netflix series when you were in the paddock? Or do you think, do you know what? It would have been nice to have an insight there. You could have been Günther.
When I watched it, I was thinking there could have been a whole 9 episodes on Lotus. If they'd been following Lotus in 2015, with us not having tires given to us in Hungary because we hadn't paid Pirelli, having no hospitality in Mexico because we couldn't afford to pay the circuit, having going to the high court because we had the VAT office trying to close a business down, dealing with Renault, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If any of that, scoring a podium in Belgium when we had bailiffs in the garage at the time, I mean, it just would have written itself.
Well, you could write it. I would read it if you wrote a book detailing all of those fun stories. I mean, it does sounds, you know, very intriguing and in long form.
Yeah, that was just one season. But yeah, it was 2015 was a crazy season. It really was a crazy season.
And of course, Haas has a link to you because a lot of your old employees ended up at Haas.
Yeah, so when Romain went, he took our senior race engineer, quite a few of the mechanics, the strategist, all went to Haas with, well, not necessarily with Romain actually, but they kind of followed Romain there. So yeah, when I walked on the paddock now, there's probably as many familiar faces at Haas as there are at Renault.
So I've just finished listening to the Beyond the Grid, which had Günther Steiner on it, presumably to cash in on his popularity from the Netflix series. But that business model that they have, very different. So Günther Steiner's there talking about how, you know, they come in and they said, well, we can't do the same thing as the Manners and the Marussias that are failing. So we've got to do something else. And I was actually quite surprised how candid he was, because he's basically saying, you know, the model is essentially customer team light, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is very much so. They've got a very different approach. I mean, I think it did annoy a lot of the more traditional teams, the way that they went about it. As he says on that podcast, which I listened to this morning as well, actually, they didn't do anything that was outside of the rules. They didn't do anything that anyone else can't do. It was interesting in there that he actually, when he talked about, he made an interesting comment about money and cash. I think he was talking a little bit about when he was at Jaguar and the fact that Ford wouldn't put any money into the team and that you needed to invest money to make a move up the grid. And I think they've done that quite well in terms of, I mean, obviously I have a little bit of history with Manor as well. And the difference between the way Haas have approached it in terms of money and the way that Manor could approach it in terms of money is vastly different.
I think we've spoken offline about Manor and keep saying we should talk about it on the podcast. So, I mean, that team came in. Was it too much ambition, or was it just too difficult to get into F1 at that time? What was the main failing?
They were in F1. They so the iteration of Manor that I briefly worked for was, so they were Marussia, and they were Manor, and then a guy called Stephen Fitzpatrick bought the team 2015, I guess he bought it. But the difference, I think, the difference between that model, the Caterham Marussia HRT type model, was the, and again, it's kind of referenced in the podcast by Günther, is the backer, is the fact that Gene Haas has got the cash that he's put into it. Now, the guy who bought Manor was a wealthy guy, but wealthy doesn't really cut it in F1. You need to be a bit more than that. And I think it's interesting that when Haas came in, the drivers that they got, So Roman went there straight away, and I know that they paid him good money. Certainly money that the smaller teams can't afford to do. More money than he would have got at Toro Rosso. Certainly more than he would have got at Sauber at the time. So they offered good wages. And the first season they had Gutierrez in there as well. And he brought a lot of sponsorship money, but didn't necessarily score the points. And that was kind of the position that we were in with Pasta and a little bit where Williams are today as well. And I think that Gene Haas has got the wherewithal to realize that and to say, okay, we need two drivers that are going to score us points regularly. And then they went out and got Magnussen.
Universally, listeners and the feedback we get when you come on, Matthew, is positive and people love you. But we should remember that you facilitated Pastor Maldonado. You are Maldonado Zero, pretty much. You kept him going. No Carter, no Maldonado.
I don't really understand what you mean. You mean if the team hadn't kept going, he wouldn't have kept going.
Well, presumably you had a hand in keeping him on as a driver.
No.
Oh.
No. They signed the deal at the end of 2013. I mean, it was when I walked in there in 2013, I walked into a storm of mess. They had agreed to take Pasta from Williams because he was bringing a huge amount of money from the oil PDVSA, the oil company in Venezuela. And Pasta moved from Williams to Lotus because Williams were so poor at the time. They were sort of towards the back end of the grid and Lotus were doing fairly well. He came into Lotus when the regulations changed and we had the terrible Renault engine, and he went from the back of the grid to probably even further at the back of the grid. And the guys from PDVSA, the Venezuelans, were pumping huge amounts of cash into the team. And they thought that they were going upwards. And if you remember that first season, Williams did incredibly well. So I think the first race, did they get a podium in the first race? Or they did very, very well. And we were 21st and 22nd at the time.
So I just want to get a little bit of clarification on why Pastor Maldonado was not your choice. Were you saying that it was not your prerogative in your role, or you were locked in with the contract, or just that the money that the Venezuelan oil company was bringing in was just so much that if it was lost, it would just be impossible to figure out how to carry on?
Has he frozen?
I think he has frozen.
Oh, well, there we go. Hopefully he'll come back. We just missed the beginning of that answer, Matthew. I apologize. Could you cut out?
I said a little bit of all of the above. So yes, the money was good. The contract was signed before I walked in the door. So the contract was signed, done, dusted before I walked in. So 2014, I had no option. I had Romain Grosjean and Pastor Maldonado. They were our two drivers. They were signed. Both of them were on long contracts. But as we know, that's not to say that you can't break a contract, but certainly that first year, there was no way I was going to break a contract with Pasta. I was responsible for bringing Charles Peak in as the reserve driver, and we managed to get some cash from him. And then 2015, again, it was a toss-up as to whether or not we took someone the likes of Sergio Perez, or we stuck with Pastor Maldonado. And I was slightly overruled from above, and we stayed with Maldonado.
I just have to play some what if, I guess. So what if you had come in and you decided that you did want to break that contract because, you know, no one's holding a gun to your head to make Pastor drive for you? How do you think you could have gotten somebody else to come in and drive for you? Or do you think that would have negatively, irreparably hurt your reputation as someone who didn't kind of honor the terms of the deal?
Interesting terminology, gun at the head, with the Venezuelans that were behind Pasta. But anyway, we'll move on from
not
that.
Not intentional, not a political statement. Mr. Apex has no, we're not an embassy or anything like that.
We're covered.
Good save. Could I have got anyone else? Yeah, I mean, we were in discussions. I think Sergio Perez would have come. You're an F1 team, for crying out loud. You can get a driver to come to you for sure. And at the time, Lotus were, I'd like to think we were midfield. We certainly weren't the worst cars on the grid. So I'd like to think that we could have got another driver fairly easily. But there was a contract in place. It was good in terms of the money that he was paying for his seat. And we had Roman there. And certainly that first year, I had bigger fish to fry than to worry about past.
We've got a nice question from the chat room here, Matthew. Could you please ask Mr. Carter, after how many years does he think he would become obsolete as a team principal after being away from F1? But from the stories we've heard today, I mean, you winged it once. Surely you could just drop in and do it again.
Obsolete from F1. I have no idea. I mean, again, listening to Gunter Steiner was away from the sport for a number of years, wasn't
he? Oh, that's
right. Doing NASCAR,
yes.
Or something, yeah. And he came back. I mean, it's all about opportunity. And I think we've discussed on here many times, there are only 10 team principals. And of those 10, I would say currently 10 are pretty much cemented into their positions. There's not many. I mean, the ones that were sort of teetering were obviously Areva Bene. He's now been replaced. Claire isn't actually a team principal issue. She's deputy team principal.
Are you sure you've got no links to the Williams family anywhere? No blood ties hidden away deep in the Carter ancestry?
Maybe I should do that DNA for me or whatever it's called.
I think we're going to talk a bit about Williams because about half, do you reckon, Nick, of the questions we got on Twitter were Williams based?
A surprising proportion, a very high question to pace ratio.
Okay, so we're going to ask Matthew Carter his opinions on Williams after a word from our sponsors.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're back. Williams. Now, I know you have no relationship with Williams, Matthew. However, it is a fascinating example of a team struggling with their finances, something you do have experience of. And I mean, going back to them going to testing and missing the first few days, it's a desperate situation when you've got all the other cars going around on track. I mean, Claire Williams seems to publicly be saying, no, it's nothing to do with money. The fact that we can't get spare parts, that's nothing to do with money. Not turning up for testing was nothing to do with money. It's to do with X, Y, Z reasons. But it seems an awful lot like it's money.
Yes.
Good. Moving on to Renault.
I concur. No, I think it definitely is to do with money. And they can, and I think that's obvious. You know. But having said all that, you know, you have to realize that when you're in front of the media, you have to try and put a positive spin on things for your sponsors and for people that are reading this, reading and consuming the media. But obviously it's fairly obvious it's to do with money. I mean, if it was not to do with money, then they could have turned up with last year's car to go testing to at least give the drivers some time on the track. They would have got dispensation to do that for sure. They could have tested the tyres based on last year's car. They could have botched a front wing on a rear wing to make sure that they had something to go testing with. But they clearly didn't. They didn't have the money. And we missed testing in 2014 for very similar reasons. And there's long lead times on F1 parts. And if you don't pay at the time that you're supposed to pay, you get shunted down the list. It's fairly hard, but it's a fact of life.
Ah, right. Explain that to me a little bit, because I think a lot of people were yelling at me when I suggested it was money and they couldn't pay for parts.
Can you change that?
People yell at me a lot. People are mean. Although actually people say a lot of nice things. If you want to leave us nice comments on iTunes, you could as well. A 5-star review. You can say whatever you want as long as it's 5 stars. You can have a go at Nick's beard. Yeah, you can attack me physically as long as it's five stars, I'm happy. So the thinking is, well, if I contract a unique part and I say, make me this thing for my car, and then I can't pay, the manufacturer is sat there with this part and you can't then sell it to Ferrari to put into their car. So what am I missing?
The whole point of the conversation.
Oh, right. Okay. Good.
So it's not that. So the unique parts. So, okay. So aside from Haas, because they have their own business model, which is different from everyone else, the unique parts are pretty much all built and made by the teams in house. So Williams will have their own body shop, their own modeling shop where they build the carbon fiber parts that they need. The bits I'm talking about are things that, so for example, I think 9 of the 10 teams use X-Track gearboxes. And X-Track only have so much capacity to produce gearboxes. And therefore, if you say to X-Track, okay, we need a gearbox for the 1st of January, and they say, okay, you're in for build week, whatever, you have to pay us this amount of money on whatever, they're not going to just wait for the money to arrive. They've become savvy to that. Enough teams have gone bankrupt for them to realize that just because they're dealing with an F1 team doesn't mean they're going to get paid. So if you slip down the line on gearbox, brakes are another one. There's only a couple of manufacturers of brakes. I think there was Brembo and I can't remember the other company. There's two companies that make brakes. And the lead time on them is incredibly long as well. So if they've got Ferrari asking for double the quantity and Lotus asking for a quantity and Lotus can't afford to pay the deposit, then they just shunt you down the line. And
and presumably they can just hold those brakes for when Ferrari do want new brakes.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So yeah, I mean, I was roundly shouted down a lot when we were saying about Williams, but a vindication, wouldn't you say? I'd say vindication.
I would say so. I couldn't believe that feedback. Like, of course it's money. It's always money.
Exactly. I mean, yes. I mean, it is always money. I mean, I was going to make some like outlandish analogy, but it is, of course it is. I mean, there's no way that someone's missed the fact that the testing was happening on this date and they've suddenly thought, oh, I can't believe testing's crept up on us like that. I mean, it's money for sure.
They fired their team manager for that one.
Yeah. I mean, my general thoughts on Williams run quite deep with all that sort of stuff.
Well, can I interrupt with a question from our Slack group? Because Ray said, during your time as team principal, did you have any dealings with what he calls the current Williams fall boy, Paddy Lowe? What are your impressions of Lowe? And then, you know, from my point of view, was he just taking the brunt of the, like, there must be a sacrifice to the F1 gods?
So Paddy was at Mercedes at my time. So yes, I dealt with, so we... we moved from Renault to Mercedes 2014 to 2015. So Toto, a guy called Andy Cowell, who runs the engine department, and Paddy were the three guys that I dealt with to negotiate the contract for them to supply us with engines. So I know him reasonably well. And yeah, he's a good guy. He seems competent. I mean, I didn't work with him. Do I think he was the fall guy? I guess a little bit. I think they maybe had to be a fall guy. But my thoughts on Williams are that they were probably, along with Force India, were the biggest gainers from the regulation change in 2014. So they stumbled onto the Mercedes engine. I think I've maybe not said this before. So Lotus were offered a Mercedes engine prior to 2014. For a quarter of the price of the Renault engine. And they signed a long-term agreement with Renault because during the prior to the hybrid era, the Renault engine was obviously the best. They'd just come off the back of Red Bull winning 4 world championships. Lotus had been fairly successful with them, so they decided that Renault was the way to go.
When you point out all those things, it sounds reasonable.
Yes. So Williams, I don't think ran out and chose Mercedes and made a genius decision. And the same with Force India as it was at the time. What they stumbled into maybe is a little bit harsh, but they stumbled into 2014 with by far the best engine. I mean, our Renault engine couldn't get round a lap of the circuit sometimes. I mean, it was just braking left, right, and center, whether it was in our car or in the Red Bull. So the Mercedes engine all of a sudden pinged Williams from 11th in the constructors or wherever they finished in 2013, right up to third or fourth. I'll assert the fact that it was basically all down to the engine and the fact that they had that engine, which was so much faster than all the others. They then, if you look at their progression since then, they've gradually, as the regulations have become more stable and the other engines catch up with the Mercedes, Williams have gradually gone backwards because their aero, in my opinion, was never that good. So they had a false dawn in terms of look how good we are because we're getting these great results. And it was nothing to do with the aero or the chassis component. It was all to do with the engine is my opinion on where they are. And I think as the other engines have caught up, their lack of a coherent chassis aerodynamic model has been found out, and that's where they are.
Sorry, no, it's right. Well, they started really high, I think, in testing 2014 before they got the Martini deal. And they seem to sort of come out, obviously in testing, you don't have to run everything quite spec. I think there was suddenly like at the top in day two or three, signed the Martini deal, then, you know, strapped on their real aero and weren't quite as good. But if aero has been their problem and that hasn't changed, isn't that something that could have been addressed in the last 5 years for a top team?
But that's where, in my opinion, I think that's where their problem lies. And I think that is probably why they brought Paddy Lowe in. I don't think they gave him enough time to deal with it. And I think they probably did use him as a little bit of a fall guy. But yes, of course, yeah, they needed to. But it's easy to say that when you're in the bubble. And I came in looking at F1 with fresh eyes, I guess, a little bit. But that was why, I mean, did Lotus go from 8th to 5th in the championship fighting for 4th from 2014 to 2015 because I was a genius and the aerodynamics department? No, we went from Renault to a Mercedes engine.
No.
But absolutely no question of a doubt that pinged us from, we got a podium for God's sake in Spa. No, that was nothing to do with the fact that the Lotus suddenly became the greatest, most aerodynamically efficient car on the grid. It was because we had the best engine, and as we've discussed many times, at that time, Mercedes didn't want Vettel to score points, so they gave us extra boost when we needed it.
So this show is your opportunity to self-proclaim yourself as a genius. I just want to be clear that you can make all sorts of wild assertions about yourself. So I wanted to ask...
I was going to say, I think it was genius not to continue with Renault, but anyway.
Fair enough. I wanted to ask, because I don't think we've had you on since the season has begun, or I'm sure that we haven't, with the aero regulations becoming more simple this year, wouldn't you have expected Williams to improve? I mean, is their station at the back, as far back as it is, shocking to you?
Is it shocking to me? No, because the aero rules have been simplified, but that doesn't necessarily make it easier to build a fast car. It just means that you have to, it almost makes it more difficult because you have to look outside the box a little bit. And that's why you're seeing some sort of intricate changes further down from the front wing. I mean, some different approaches to the front wing for sure, but you kind of have to look outside of the box and around the box a little bit more. In my opinion, the other teams have taken a step forward, and that's generally financial. So Toro Rosso have always been fairly stable, but I think that Honda came in, and I think that Red Bull gave Toro Rosso a little bit more cash to work with Honda. Sauber, obviously, with the Alfa Romeo money, have suddenly taken a step forward. They've got better drivers, and they've obviously improved their aero. So all of a sudden, if the midfield all starts to take a step in the right direction, then someone has to end up at the back. There's no Caterhams or Manners or, you know, kicking around anymore. It's that midfield is really hard fought, and I think it just means that Williams have been found out.
So a couple of Twitter questions, because I don't know if Rodere knows my relationship history, but, you know, when Samantha was treating me badly, I went and I had a couple of years with Vicky Edwards, and then that all went wrong. And I went, well, maybe Samantha wasn't so bad. It turned out to be a sign of desperation. Is the return of Patrick Head to save Williams a sign of desperation and unwillingness to modernize the teams and or accept that Ms. Edwards was probably the right one all along?
I never had any dealings with Patrick because I think he left in 2011. So it was before my time. My understanding is that he's a pretty hard-nosed, blunt person. So maybe that's what they need. Maybe they need someone to go in there and to rattle some cages. I think it's easy within a Formula One team for people to, certainly in a Formula One team that's not doing very well, for people to get on easy street. And to not really go the extra yards. And I've seen reference to Leclerc at Sauber last year as being one of those examples when the mechanics and the engineers, suddenly when they realised they had a driver that was capable of giving them some good results, they suddenly up their game, and suddenly the pit stops start getting faster, and suddenly the aero guys stay a little bit longer at night, and It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously makes sense that all those engineers, they need to have purpose in what they're doing. And if they're working late for a driver who's just going to shunt anyway, then there's no point. And I hope you're right that Patrick Head is the personality that they need to kick things in gear and get things going, because I don't want to see them as far back as they are just because they're not in the mix and it's not interesting. But my gut is telling me, asking what made the team successful in the past and kind of returning to that and assuming that it will help you be successful again in the future is kind of a logical fallacy. And I think they need to go in a, my gut would tell me that you should probably go in a different direction altogether, but
like
I don't know, Patrick.
Yeah, like a Carter-esque.
No, I agree. I don't think I necessarily said he was the right. I said that he,
it's possible.
If he's fairly no nonsense and he's going to rattle some cages, then so be it. I don't necessarily agree that what worked in the past is going to work in the future, because Formula One has moved on. Even since my time, I think it's moved on. It's a different formula now than it was.
Right. So I wasn't trying to say that you were backwards thinking. I was saying that it may appear that Williams may be backwards thinking. Just want to clear that air.
I tell you what, I want to finish up by talking about what has become your old team at Renault, because I know you have a lot of loving feelings towards Renault as a Formula One team. You sit there on a Sunday in all yellow, you know, they go, oh, your dad's gone into his banana colours for the F1 race. But before that, I just want to tell you guys about an opportunity to come and hang out with some of the Mist Apex crew. Mr. Carter, why aren't you coming karting with us? Just hop on your private yellow jet and come karting with us at Roy House.
I think I'm busy that weekend.
Washing his hair, no doubt. But if you're not busy on April 20th, why not come karting with us at Rye House? It's just north of the northernmost point of the M25 near Harlow, near a town called Hoddesdon. You can race at the back if you're rubbish with me and Chris and Jeansy, or if you're really good, you can test yourself up front with the likes of Kyle Power, Alex Brundle, and Bradley Philpott, who will all definitely be up at the front. You won't beat them, but it is fantastic being on track with drivers of that caliber. Rye House has got new machines. They have a brand new fleet of Biz Twin Le Mans Cuts, 36 brand new machines, and they will only be a month old when we get there, which is the perfect time to drive karts. But you can come and race in these new karts with us. What we'll have is we'll have 9 heats, and you'll fight for a place in 3 finals. The track itself is genuinely fantastic. There's about 3 or 4, I reckon, of that caliber of outdoor tracks in the UK, and Rye House is one of them. We're doing a live podcast at 11 a.m. and you can be in the live audience, and then at 1 p.m. we'll have our briefings and get going for the heats at 2 p.m. So if you want to get involved in that, go to mistapexpodcast.com/karting, or you can email me spannersready@gmail.com. hope to see you there. The edit will reflect that that was quite a good plug for the karting event. However, Matthew Carter, so the team that you were in charge of ended up becoming Renault. So I'm sure you obviously follow that team with interest, if not a genuine supporter in yellow cheering on, go on, Cyril, you can do it.
Is there a question there? What was the question? Do I follow
them? I'm sure you follow them quite closely out of curiosity.
I... Yeah. Yes. Yes.
They have one of the most interesting driver dynamics at the moment because, you know, Formula One answers questions very slowly. So we learn about drivers very slowly over their career. Nico Hülkenberg considered a bit of a journeyman, and now he's got the supposed megastar, Daniel Ricciardo, who's come in from a reputation of being fast, punchy overtaker, super nice bloke. Hasn't hit the ground running at Renault, so I just wondered what your opinion was.
My opinion, Julian beat Hülkenberg on occasion, therefore Julian's better than Ricciardo.
Huh. Yeah.
No, okay. No. What my opinion is that moving from one team to another, from one car to another, is not as easy as it would appear from the outside. And I think Ricciardo's come on record and said that he's overdriving the car. I think he is still expecting it to do what a Red Bull does. And if anything, it has highlighted the shortfalls between the Renault and the Red Bull.
Well, yeah, I think it was to the BBC. He made a comment along the lines of, like, he's still used to a car that drives better or something. And it's not a great indictment of the team you've just moved to. If you want to make friends and influence people, do you necessarily want to say, I've been making mistakes because I'm used to a much better car?
Did he say better or did he say different?
No, all right, I'll find the quote.
Well, oh, really? Well,
no, Nick, no, you jump in, I'll okay. find the quote.
I think he said it's rear stability through corners at speed, which is code for better.
Yeah. But the only reason I question it is because I know the way that they are told what to say in front of the cameras and the way I was told what to say in front of the cameras and to be careful. But for sure, I mean, the Red Bull is a completely better car than the Renault. And it was shown when they had the same engines that it was a better car. And as I've said many times, you know, each year is just really an iteration of the previous year's car. So it's not as if Renault have suddenly torn up the aerodynamic rule book and come out with an amazing car.
Yeah. So the, I forget what his exact role was, but somebody on the board of directors, I believe his name was Ghosn. He is
Carlos. Yep.
Carlos Ghosn. Yeah. What do you think that will do since he had historically been a proponent for Renault being in Formula One in the first place?
So he was the guy that was arrested in Japan, maybe 6 months ago, something like that. Over some sort of irregularities with company money. And he was the guy that was the main driver behind Renault buying Lotus, or one of the main drivers. I think Cyril was the one that put the plan together, but Carlos was for sure the guy that from the top level was the one that pushed it and made the decision, because they were teetering very much 50-50 on whether or not to pull out of F1 completely or to go the opposite route, which would be to continue to supply engines and also to be a team. And they made that decision. And I was privy to some of those conversations. And I know that he was one of the only guys that was pushing originally for them to go fully into Formula One. So he turned other board members around. Having said all that, they've now invested enough money into it that it's going to be difficult for them to take a step backwards, I think. Whether or not they will get the sign off to really challenge Mercedes and Ferrari and Red Bull, I'm not so sure, because I think he would have been the guy that would have made the argument for that. Because it's quite a difficult argument, because if they really go full bloodedly for Mercedes and Ferrari and they fail, what does that say about them? And have they got that? I mean, I know they've got the resources because they're such a powerful company, but it's whether or not they're prepared to put those resources into Formula One.
Right. They do have the resources, and that is why it would make any inkling of sense that Ricciardo would go to drive for them at all. So it's, you know, they're not challenging Mercedes and Ferrari right now, but with the way that the top teams have their business model set up, the only team that could even theoretically challenge Mercedes and Ferrari would be another giant works manufacturer. So I wonder what having a new top flight driver will do for their commitment in the sport, and also possibly a new, more favorable cost cap scenario. So, I mean, if you take the whole ceiling of what the spending would be and bring it down, could you foresee a point where they could be spending with the likes of Mercedes and challenging at the top?
Yeah, they definitely could be. I think that even with everything that's come out recently, I still think they're quite a long way away from a real cost cap. Even in 2014, 2015, when I was going to the strategy group meetings, there was discussions of cost cap, and the big teams have always got ways around it. They pull out drivers' wages from the cost cap. They pull out senior management wages. They pull out R&D expenses. There's all sorts of things that they can pull out of the cost cap to enable them to continue to spend an incredible amount of money. Having said all that, Renault have got the resources and they could get up there. I just honestly think that the gap at the moment is so big in terms of facilities, in terms of personnel, in terms of quality of personnel, that it's going to be difficult for them to get back.
Right at the top, Matthew? Would you say that the lack of quality starts right at the top of the team? Or?
A Renault, yeah. For sure. but one of the things that happened at Lotus in that period, so just prior to me going there, was a lot of the very, very good. So as soon as you don't pay someone on the month they're supposed to be paid, then they have a right to terminate their contract or to start looking out elsewhere. Because a lot of the senior personnel in Formula One are on contracts a bit like footballers. So they're not allowed to go and look for alternate work. You know, they would be forced to do a year, 2 years of gardening leave before they could go to another team because there's so many secrets and confidentiality, et cetera, et cetera. The minute that you stop paying or you don't pay someone or you miss a month's payment, or I think it's if you miss two in 2 months, then they're allowed to go and talk elsewhere. And that's why James Allison left and went to Ferrari. We lost our chief strategist. We lost our chief. This is all prior to me arriving. The senior race engineer, a couple of our mechanics. So there was a huge loss of personnel. And those type of people with that knowledge in F1 are very hard to re-recruit or to recruit in the first place. So there's not many Adrian Newey's kicking around. There's not many James Allison's kicking around. And it was fairly well known that James Allison was really the reason that Lotus did so well in 2012, 2013.
Oh, right, really? Because, I mean, he obviously off the back of that, he then, you know, went to Ferrari and his stock has risen and you feel that was justified?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a very, very clever guy. He's quite a strange character, but he's a very, very clever guy. And I think he's maybe up there with Adrian Newey. But he's certainly in the realms of, I mean, there was, as we talked before about Paddy Lowe, I think he's a cut above Paddy Lowe.
And tell you what, Erudite in the chat room says, Matthew Carter, greater than, it's the one where the crocodile eats the one that's bigger, isn't it? That's how maths works. What? Better than Cyril Abitbol. So there you go. You've got fans in the chat room.
It's not even a question. There's never up for discussion, surely.
Tell you what is it up for discussion is, look, you are still an F1 fan, probably more of an F1 fan now than before you entered the sport. How are you enjoying this season? Because we're going to talk about some regulation changes, but this season was meant to be the season they could all follow. And I don't know if this is a false dawn, but I mean, Bahrain, for example, was just like one of the best F1 races and starts I can remember for a long time.
It was, yeah, no, it was really good. It was, Bahrain always provides good racing. I think, yes, the cars are easier. It's easier to follow because they've spent so much time and effort to make that happen. It was obviously going to happen. I think the introduction of the extra DRS zone as well was quite key. And I think that's something that needs to be looked at a lot of tracks because DRS, people like it, people don't like it. It's made more powerful this year because they've a bigger flap to open. I think that made a difference. I think you could see overtakes and then re-overtakes or overtakes and people pulling away or whatever. It was, I thought the Bahrain race was a really good race. I actually genuinely enjoyed it for the first time in quite a while. And all of it as well. There wasn't really a period where you could walk away from the TV and come back and something hadn't happened.
Bahrain is a track, Nick, that is good, isn't it? It is good anyway. So I think the real test will come when we get to somewhere like Barcelona or Sochi, goodness.
Yeah, I was just thinking, imagine if somebody walked away from the Bahrain Grand Prix with, you know, 12 laps to go, thinking that, well, this is all sorted, this is all wrapped up. Well, you can't do that. You had to watch it all the way to the end, and with the multiple pit stops, it was brilliant.
Sebastian Vettel recently, Matthew, came out and said, "Oh, F1's too much about the show and not enough about the drivers, and I might consider quitting in 2021 if it turns out Leclerc is really good. I mean, if they continue down that path with the 2021 regulations." But there's nothing wrong with a bit of show, is there? I mean, you've been involved in a lot of strategy groups, and Bahrain is, you know, it's under the lights, there's big sparks. Like there was one point where Albon, he looked like you know, one of these Las Vegas acts with a chainsaw and sparks on a lady's metal suit. There was just sparks like flying in his face, and it just looked spectacular. What's wrong with a bit of a show? And, you know, do you remember having arguments with people to that regard? Did the team principals get involved?
Yeah,
in that?
No, they. So Bahrain's quite interesting. So Bahrain originally was not a night race. And what actually happened is Bahrain, they, like most of these circuits, they use the Grand Prix to market their city or their country or however it's going to work. So Visit Bahrain is obviously a big is a big signage all around there. And what they realized was that during the day, from the overhead shots, it was very obvious that it was in the middle of a desert with basically shanty towns around the edge of it.
Oh, no way. That's not the reason.
And they also realized that the grandstands were fairly empty. So they came up with the genius idea of changing it to a night race. And then when all the lights are on and the helicopter flies over the top, you just see pitch black and a gorgeous circuit. And you don't see that the grandstands aren't necessarily as full as they are when you go to Silverstone or...
So, I mean, you either go that route or you go the Baku route of just cardboard buildings. They weren't tempted just to build a lot of cardboard buildings. It's worked. So I've fallen for that.
For sure. As a show, it's great. And then moving on to that, onto the show, I was sat in the strategy group meeting where Bernie Eccleston produced a picture of Ayrton Senna going through Eau Rouge from whatever year that would have been, with sparks flying out the bottom of his car. And he showed it to all the team principals and he said, "We need more sparks in Formula One." And on the back of that, they actually set up a working group to design the best way to make the sparks fly. So a group of engineers were sent out to work out which particular metal produced the most sparks when in contact with asphalt. And they came up with so then they changed the regulations for 2015. It was written into the regulations that the plank underneath the car had to be made of a specific titanium grade 04216 or whatever the hell it was. And every plank had to be made of the same in order that when the cars touched the ground, they sparked.
That's just the most classic old CEO story I've ever heard. I've had so many similar work experiences where the CEO comes in, he has a picture and he just taps it with his index finger. He's like, "This, I want this, make this happen." And it doesn't matter why it happened, whether it's practical, how it's going to be done, how long it was going to take, whether he'll remember it a month from now, what he asked. He just wants the thing.
Slightly disparaging story as well, but Stephen Fitzpatrick, the guy that bought Manor, one of the many reasons that I didn't stay there for very long, he produced a picture of the Mercedes car in a meeting with all the senior engineers and said, "Why can't we just copy this?" I genuinely sat there and watched him do it.
Wow. And was he surrounded by yes men? Because I want to be surrounded by yes men. That would be my aim. I guess he found out whether he had yes men or not.
That's why I'm here.
Exactly. Hence I'm here. Yeah. Hence I didn't continue there. But yes, I mean, at the time, so it was, if you remember, they signed a deal to have a Mercedes engine. And they had, so this was for 2016, wasn't it? So they had a Mercedes engine and a Williams gearbox and a Williams rear suspension. And he basically thought that that was obviously, therefore they were going to be world champions.
Right. This is benchmarking. It's a common business practice and it's totally, totally ethical. You just see what people are doing and you just do the same thing.
Copy. Yeah.
Matthew Carter,
copy paste.
Thank you very much for your time and thanks for joining me in my shed and on Missed Apex podcast. You are going to be next at a Grand Prix when? In Canada, since you are a Canadian resident?
I think I'm going to go to the Monaco Grand Prix, actually.
So you're going to go to the Monaco Grand Prix, and are you one of these that says, even though millions of people are sat at home going, it's really good for the people that are there, so, you know, chin chin?
No, the Monaco Grand Prix is all about the show, but not the show that goes on the track.
It's not for the likes of us.
It's all about schmoozing your big sponsors. It's all about more driver deals and negotiations go on there than anywhere else. The whole setup of the weekend's different, as I'm sure you know. So practice is on Thursday. Friday's a day off where everyone basically goes to the paddock and talks shop. And, you know, you bring your best sponsors and you put them on a big boat and you encourage them to sign a deal for the following year.
Fantastic. Nick, do we have any comment of the week candidates?
We don't. We don't traditionally do comment of the week with special guests, was my understanding.
I thought you were all over it. Pick one completely at random then. Scroll up a little bit. I'll give you a chance to scroll up while I play this.
Comment of the week.
And the random comment of the week is?
Max Verstappen.
That was the comment.
Maria Rivera. It's Max Verstappen.
Fantastic. Genius. Not even in context or anything. Well done.
Comment of the week.
You can follow Nick Alexander on Twitter at Nick Alexander F1. He's got a book podcast where he invites people on who haven't read a book to talk about it. Is that the whole premise of the podcast, Nick?
Almost. You almost have it. But yeah. I think I'm starting to get the feeling that you deliberately misunderstand things for humor.
I would never do that.
But yeah, so we read a book and then we invite one person on who's not read the book and we just discuss it. And it's kind of a book club among friends. And you can
Anyone else or just the one person that hasn't read it?
Just the one person who hasn't read it and two or three people who have.
But you didn't say that. You just said we invite one person on who hasn't read it.
No, that's what Spanner said. Spanner's misled you. I tried to correct the record.
Are you doing it in a nice way or is it like a mean way where like you hate them, they want to enjoy the book, but you're giving them spoilers so they won't enjoy it?
We actually think the whole 2 weeks that we're reading the book of what a much better ending would have been. And we tell them that that was the ending and then they go and read it and are disappointed. Long game.
I love it. I love that. I had an idea because Tony Thunderbeast Barnard, I keep saying his surname. He doesn't want me to. Never mind. He's not here to defend himself. He wanted me to sponsor him for something fun. I said, no, instead I'll sponsor you to not watch any of the new Game of Thrones series until the end. But every week I sit and spoil all the episodes for you and tell you how much I enjoyed it. But he didn't go for that. He said he'd rather pay the money himself. You can't follow Matthew Carter anywhere because he refuses to go on Twitter. You do, don't you? You refuse to be publicly on Twitter. I bet you've got a sock account where you rant and rave at people and stuff, but...
No, I just refuse.
You just refuse.
I refuse wholeheartedly.
In that case, you'll just have to follow Matthew Carter in real life. You can look out for him. He's the one with the Wolverine hair and the shocking beard at the moment. You can follow the show at Mist Apex F1 and myself at Spanners Ready. And please consider supporting us at patreon.com/MissedApex. Until next time, remember that wounds heal, chicks dig scars, and glory lasts forever. This was Missed Apex. Sorry, Nick, forgot to mention the name of your podcast. Do you know what? How good can a podcast about books really be?
Not very good. That's not but it is called What's It About Podcast, and we are on Stitcher and iTunes and all that.
Yeah, okay. E-Radio. I should plug E-Radio, shouldn't I? Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.